Romans 13, verse 5. Romans 13, verse 5. Wherefore you must needs be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. In the previous verses, Paul has developed his picture of the good ruler, the good governor. In it, he's spoken of his purpose. He is, as he said, a minister of God for good. And he's emphasized, in fact, the personal connection which should enforce this for each one who hears his teaching. He is a minister of God to thee for good. In other words, the apostle is arguing here the interest that every person of mankind has in this ordinance. Everyone who hears of this has an interest and should, in fact, be interested in what is good government, what is, in fact, government that is the ordinance of God. He's arguing that the civil ruler is, in some sense, that the bearer of a common good. If only each person approximates a reasonable outward conformity to the moral law, as he's noted in verse 3. Do that which is good. Now, if you yourself approach or approximate that moral good, you're going to recognize in a good ruler that which is good. You're going to understand that that is a good ruler. Conversely, if you don't, you're really going to have a lot of trouble understanding what it is Paul's talking about here. Now, the juxtaposing of the good works under which the ruler is not a terror, and the command to do that which is good in verse 3, with his assertion that the civil ruler is a minister of God to thee for good in verse 4, all of that should have been enough to convince every gainsayer that what the apostle is teaching, what the apostle is saying, he can only here have in view that which is really and properly good. And good in the Bible is defined by conformity to the moral law of God. In fact, I would go so far as to say that good outside of the Bible, because of the natural morality, good outside of the Bible is defined by that which reflects the moral law of God. It conforms to the moral law of God. So this language is not then concerned with some substandard notion of goodness, some sort of lower degree of goodness. Because goodness, as Paul would have understood it, and goodness even as the best heathen philosophers would have understood it, that goodness is a reflection of conformity to the moral law of the divinity, the deity. So the language isn't concerned with some substandard notion of goodness. Much less does this language speak of good improperly. The language here assumes a standard of moral conformity to the divine law, whether it's written in the hearts of the Gentiles or as it's published amongst the Jews on two tables of stone. Thus, Paul calls the civil ruler a minister of God. A minister, or as the Greek word here indicates, a deacon. One concerned with administration more so than legislation. His duty does not stand in defining what is good and evil. Rather, his duty stands in conforming himself and his administration to that already existing standard of God's moral law. And precisely as a minister of God, he does not have leeway to add to or subtract from that body of commands contained in that moral law. There isn't this kind of freedom. Nor does any authority on earth have the power to dispense with or loose him from the obligations of this law, including those obligations pertaining to the first table of the law, man's duty to God. To make any such assertion is merely the kind of assertion and claim that the papists would make. Again, as a minister of God, Paul asserts the duties of that civil ruler which pertain to him as the ordinance of God. First, he says, he has the power of the sword. His realm, he's saying, is not the spiritual kingdom of grace, it's the natural kingdom of dominion. To him, to the civil ruler, belongs the general obligation of mankind expressed in that mandate in Genesis 1. God blessed them and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So to the civil ruler belongs the task of standing at the head of families and nations of men to see that this commandment, which was given by nature's God, is actually carried into effect. Thus, he has a rightful concern, then, for conformity to the moral law and to matters of civil order, without which it would be impossible for this dominion to be accomplished. So, as his government is to turn toward dominion, his power is that symbol of dominion, the sword. The sword is the symbol of dominion. But second, God's purpose of making civil rulers his ordinance is not simply the matter of providing some sort of unifying authority under which man may take dominion, although it is that too. But this sword, since the entrance of sin, must be, it's not optional, it must be wielded against evil. He's the minister of God who is to minister wrath to those who do wickedly. Therefore, the proper or lawful or genuine civil magistrate will wield the sword for revenge. He's going to wield it for revenge because he's one who's inflicting the just penalty for crimes committed against the moral law of God. So just as he will be forward to promote those things which are conformable to that moral law, he's not going to shrink from inflicting punishment, even lethal punishment, if that becomes necessary. Right. To this end, then, he's been given not merely power or might, you know, and I've used this distinction of words, it's not used here, that word dunamis, from which we get dynamite, not just that kind of power, raw power, but he's been given that power which is authoritative. He is a power that is exousia, a power breathing out of the substance of the divine as ordering the creation. He hasn't been given to be a law to himself, but rather to enforce the moral law of God as a minister of God for good. The good is defined not only by those positive enactments which he can make for the praise of those that do well, But the good is also defined by inflicting condign punishment upon the heads of evildoers. And it's precisely in this function that he shows himself to have a concern to remove out of his kingdom all that would damage, harm, or destroy the divine precepts by which alone men are actually enabled to take dominion over the creation. Exercising dominion in accordance then with the command of God doesn't entail a usurpation or a perversion of the grant of authority that comports with the principles of natural morality and conform to that natural moral law. In fact, the fact of sin does not lessen, but actually increases the responsibility of the magistrate to see that this law is upheld, that evil is excluded from the message and methods of men's labor to establish this dominion over the earth. The fact that sin has come in has made it more necessary now for the magistrate to turn himself to subduing and suppressing all that would impede, damage, overturn, or any way inhibit the keeping of these moral precepts. I mean, the more sins that men invent, the more purpose the magistrate has with wielding this sword. That's for this reason that there can be no throne established legitimately without a concern for righteousness. Proverbs 16:12. It's an abomination to kings to commit wickedness, for the throne is established by righteousness. There's no establishment apart from conformity to the law of God. There can't be an establishment of authority apart from conformity to the moral law of God. It's illegitimate. There's no legitimacy. There's no lawfulness to it. It's merely a claim without any warrant in any without any moral basis. Has no warrant in reality. Because reality functions and dominion is taken in accordance with the laws of God. It's not through sinning. Through sinning, man has lost the ability to take dominion. Through sinning, you lose dominion. You don't take dominion. You don't subdue things in the way that God would have them subdued, in an orderly way, under proper authority. Very simply then, any throne that makes a claim to authority without any conformity to the moral law is an abomination. As we're told in Deuteronomy 25:16, for all that do such things and all that do unrighteously are an abomination unto the Lord thy God. Such then are not thrones of legitimate authority. In fact, the Bible calls these thrones, thrones of iniquity. And such are not entitled to the respect of Christians, nor should believers yield them any attention as legitimate authorities. Psalm 94:20. Shall the throne of iniquity have fellowship with thee, which frameth mischief by a law? It's a rhetorical question. And they're defined as the throne of iniquity because they frame mischief by law. That is, they constitute sin by law. They uphold sin through law. These are thrones of iniquity. Their claims to authority are contrary to the moral law. And as such, they're not entitled to the active support of those who would not be tainted with the charge themselves of rebellion against the genuine authority of God. You support a throne of iniquity, you are in rebellion to God. You lend your active support to any kind of sin, you are complicit. And that goes for thrones of iniquity. This is not a small point, whether or not a throne, a government, a rule, a reign, an authority is actually conformed to the moral law or not. This is not simply some theoretical point. It goes to whether or not we're dealing with an actual God-ordained authority or just some loudmouth claim, usurping claim to that authority, which normally ends in some kind of tyranny. There's an important distinction then to be observed concerning magistracy, which we take from other points much discussed concerning government and its exercise. Right, the constitution of the ordinance, whether it is according to the requirement of God, determines in fact whether or not we have a valid or invalid ordinance that's been presented for our consideration. In fact, it speaks to the legality of the form of the ordinance laying claim to divine authority. The exercise of authority within this formal context must further be judged in each individual action. Because, you see, there's the possibility of having a formal validity, that is, a lawful form of government, but they can still act in an illegitimate manner. We are, after all, sinners. But if there is a formal validity or lawfulness to the constitution of authority, there has to be a presumption of a right to rule, except in cases where such commands contradict the rule of the moral law, or, if we're talking about nations favored with the light of Scripture, somehow the Bible itself. Finally, although the regard for magistracy falls under the rubric and command of the fifth commandment, it does not follow that magistracy has that kind of absolute hold upon the claim of obedience for inferiors as exists for the child to the parent. Nor can it bolster its claims against the moral law by shielding itself under the plea that this is an ordinance of nature and remains outside of the kingdom of grace. There's often an analogy drawn from the obedience that children owe to their parents, but that analogy can only be stretched so far. First of all, the obedience that children owe to their parents is always circumscribed by right and regard for the moral law of God. So Paul in Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 3 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee and that thou mayest live long on the earth." In the exercise of authority, then, parents have no authority to command, to counsel, or otherwise contravene the law of God. Or, again, in those lands favored with the gospel light, to contravene the ordinances of the gospel. And therefore, if this exception is to be found regarding the exercise of authority in parents, who are, in fact, primarily intended in the fifth commandment, after all, it says, honor thy father and thy mother, how much more than all other relations of superiors and inferiors, which are comprehended by that commandment? Second, it is to be noted that as to the constitution of that authority between the parent and the child, there's only a natural necessity whereby the child is made subject by physical birth. And this physical birth ordinarily places the body of the child under the complete control and dominion of the parents to command and control with a broad imposition, especially while the child is in a state of minority. In other words, in the case of the child and the parents, there is no requirement for the consent of the governed, which, as we will see later, is very unlike that authority vested in civil magistrates properly constituted. Furthermore, this constitution of parental authority does not rely upon a principle of reciprocity. There's a unilateral imposition of nature. This isn't a give and take between the governors and the governed. That way it's unlike civil magistracy, because there's just this imposition of nature in parental authority. Nor does parental government admit of varying outward forms. You know, when we talk about the government among men, we can talk about monarchy, aristocracy, democracy, republicanism, oligarchies, and so on. But parental government formally consists of a father and a mother from whom conjointly the child with its inborn obligations issue. The child issues with inborn obligations. And that too is unlike civil magistracy, which may admit of a variety of outward forms, as I said, none of which necessarily create a bond of obligation upon the inferior party. Third, there's a great difference between the natural and the biological ties between parents and children. There, and it, that is one thing altogether. But there's a difference between that and the political ties that exist between the sovereign and the subject. In the former case, the case of the parents, really the only way that you can cancel these ties between parents and children would be upon neglect or abandonment of the parents. The fact is, it does not lie in the power of the child to discharge the obligation to parents who've exercised themselves as parents toward the child. You can't just say, I don't want to be so-and-so's child, and it's so. But that's not so with political ties, which may be changed or canceled by the inferior, especially when such expatriation is pursued to further the cause of true religion. And so this is what's talked about in Hebrews 11, verses 13 through 16. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He hath prepared for them a city. And so, in that relation between the sovereign and the subject has a right of expatriation. The subject has a right, under all things being equal, to remove him or herself from that obligation and remove to another situation. You can leave one country and go to another country. But you can't do that with parents. Under normal circumstances, you can't do that with parents. Now, with that in mind, let's look at verse 5. Wherefore, Paul begins, by this, what Paul is meaning is that for this reason. The reason to which he refers is his doctrine of the ruler. He has described a ruler in concrete, right? He's not simply describing the theoretical ruler, but he's given us concrete attributes. He's not merely presented a civil ruler. Anyone who is inclined under whatsoever pretext to make such a claim could be. Right? You can't just claim to be a civil ruler, and as I've said again and again, and we'll see again and again, providence alone is not sufficient to make you a genuine authority. Paul said that genuine civil rulers have certain qualities which are both observable and dependable. And he's told us that these qualities have a certain bearing toward good and evil. They have a certain disposition to those who do good and another reserved for those who do evil. For all of those reasons, and Paul's not afraid to speak of it as an authority which comes from God. He doesn't hesitate, does he, to characterize it as a higher power. A higher authority in its constitution and bearing towards men. He doesn't see a problem with talking about it that way. He declares such to be the ordinance of God, because it is concerned with imposing an order that flows from God, the Creator. In fact, Paul goes on to name him as, I've said, minister or deacon of God, because he is the administrator, the highest rule, the moral law of God. There's no higher rule of right and wrong, good and evil for mankind than this moral law of God. And in fact, he's added to this certain contours, speaking to the obedience of inferiors. But such authority existing by the authority of God, arising from this highest relation between the Creator and the creature, is not to be opposed, nor is it to be resisted. You're not to interpose your own point of view there. You're not to get in the way of the legitimate functioning of authority in society. There's no authority for anyone to place his own opinion or assertion of authority in place of that which really has been bestowed by God. And he enforces that by saying to resist such authority that really comes from God is to court damnation. It must be remembered then that the authority of which Paul speaks actually exists with certain reliable and dependable characteristics. Has that formal bearing toward the law of God, which announces that it is substantially that authority from on high. Furthermore, it exists for the great purpose of aiding men in taking dominion over the earth, as I said. And thus it must bend itself not only to the promotion of that moral law, which is the summary of those necessary tools for taking this dominion, and which establishes the throne in righteousness. But again, given the entrance of sin, it must occupy the seat of justice and be prepared to use the sword for the suppression and hindrance of evil, which is destructive of those tools of dominion. Wherefore you must needs. Paul's saying these reasons create a state of necessity. That's what he's getting at here. You must needs. It really speaks to an existing necessity, a constraint discoverable in the nature of these things themselves. How could anyone, perceiving the force of the apostolic injunction, resist the conclusions toward which all of this discussion must tend? His reasons presume several things. First of all, Paul is presuming that there is a God, that there is a higher power, a higher authority, from whom all other legitimate or lawful authorities must flow, and unto which all legitimate or lawful authorities must conform and tend. Now, to this we might add that unto this God all claimants of authority shall give an account. Because, you see, every one of those who claim to have this authority are invoking the majesty of God and trading upon the name of the Most High. So that those who claim this authority, but in reality do not have this authority, they're taking God's name in vain. And that, I might suggest to you, that already indicates not only the reality of this distinction, but also the necessity in this distinction of lawful magistrates, when favored with the light of the gospel, not only not to take the name of the Lord in vain, but positively to take the name of God aright. And that is covenanting. That's not our purpose here today. Second, that there actually are conveyances of this legitimate authority from time to time. In other words, Paul's not simply theorizing, but he is indicating that this is possible, right? This is merely an exercise in the theory of government, but it's a practical exposition of government. So it holds forth not only the pattern, but he also in this place gives us the practical outworking. It's not just sticking us with a pattern. And since it can be, and sometimes actually has been realized, the counsels and the warnings of the apostle must be taken seriously as a matter of great practical interest for all men, especially Christians. And just because he's calling this legitimate or lawful authority does not mean it exists at all times and all places. But conversely, what I'm saying is, it has and does sometimes exist, at least in some places, and I would go on to assert that during the millennium it will exist in all nations, in all places. So you need to take it seriously. Third, these authorities are revealed particularly in the persons of civil rulers. And hence, the principles then discussed are practical and practicable and important for human actions and societies. And it's for that very reason, then, that this movement that is afoot, this Christian anarchism movement, this impulse to anarchism and push for the total abolition of moral and civil authority, whether under the guise of Christianity or not, it's wrong. Henry David Thoreau, in his book Civil Disobedience, famously said, "I heartily accept the motto that government is best, that government is best which governs least. And I should like to see it acted up to more rapidly and systematically. Carried out, it finally amounts to this, which I also believe, that government is best which governs not at all. And when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government that they will have." Now, this sentiment is fitting for a man of a deistic turn of thought. But it is pure utopianism, and that of the most ungodly kind. It's the only reason this kind of utopianism can exist in the mind of man is because of a hard atheism. They just really don't believe in God. And they don't understand the depth of the depravity that is in man by reason of sin. I admit I'm drawn to that kind of utopianism. I like that ideal at some level. Until I go into the house of God and I see the end of it all, and then I hate it. Fourth, he presumes that these authorities, when they appear, may be known by some few features. More generally, you're going to have a character and constitution that reflects a right relation to the precepts for which they've been delegated this authority. When in the Psalms we read of rulers, Psalm 82:6, I have said ye are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High, speaking of civil rulers, right? We have to understand then that proper rulers must have such a character and constitution. How could they be called gods if that's not the case? Why would they be called gods? What is the point in attributing to them this notion of divinity, that there's some spark of the divine in them? Furthermore, Paul looks beyond character and constitution to give us glimpses of the actual exercise. Now, this exercise must be contemplated first with respect to those who do that which is good, and second, with respect to those who do that which is evil. To the former, the exercises of lawful or legitimate magistracy are for their praise or manifestations of approval. You're going to see that you did right, right? You did well. And you did well because you did that which was good. You did well in doing good. But for the latter, they execute wrath, the evildoer. So he says, wherefore you must needs be subject. The proper relation to those who are magistrates indeed, or those who show forth themselves to be legitimate expressions of this authority, is one of submission. And this submission implies not only an obedience, but a due recognition that such a power or such an authority represents the very order and structure which God has set in the society of men and nations. It also implies the need to yield the presence of such an authority in appropriate respect. So this word that's used here by Paul is also used to enforce several relations of inferiors to superiors. For example, in Ephesians 5:22, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. Luke 2:51, speaking of Jesus, he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject unto them. But his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. Or Titus 2:9, exhort servants to be obedient unto their own masters and to please them well in all things, not answering again. To be obedient, that's the same word, to be submissive, to submit, to be subject. To be subject then is to yield to the superior all that is rightfully implied in that relation. But we need to remember then that the relation of civil magistracy, it's not the relation of one under minority, and that means it's not simply this absolute, unthinking response that a parent rightfully expects from a child in its minority. It's not a relation of one without reciprocity. The magistrate has duties too. It's not all on one end. And if they fail on their end, the obligation on your end ceases. It's a political relation that exists with distinct duties and obligations on the part of both parties, the ruler and the ruled. That's important to keep in mind. And therefore, being subject in terms of this command is not absolute. It's modified by numerous considerations, many of which Paul has given us, some of which we will see later. Wherefore you must needs be subject, not only for wrath. The apostle, he's not dismissing the function of wrath in forming a proper estimation and attitude of subjection. The word only means that he doesn't find, and this is important, a sufficient reason for subjection in the threat of condign punishment. Wrath should not be the alone, or from what the apostle seems to be saying here, even the primary motivation then for rendering obedience and subjection to a ruler. Subjection merely for wrath's sake betrays a disposition contrary to the very order that's being established by the ordinance of God. When you only subject yourself for wrath's sake, it's indicative of a restive and rebellious spirit. Think of a child who only obeys for fear of punishment. That child is not really subdued. There's a restive and rebellious spirit then that seeks to elude or evade the order that's contemplated when all of the consideration is for wrath's sake alone. But there's order contemplated as flowing from the genuine exercise of that authority arising from God, and that requires more than a simple subjection only for the sake of wrath. In fact, it's expressive of an ungovernable spirit distempered by sin to such a degree that it's become a menace to society at large when men only are responsive to the stick and not the carrot. Subjection for wrath's sake is subjection that is enforced solely under threat, solely to avoid the retributive justice which is entrusted to the ruler so that he can be a terror to evildoers. Now, the order that this fear imposes may be sufficient to restrain the wicked and interject some sort of order into the society of men. But according to the apostle here, this is actually not to be the measure of acceptable or proper subjection for those placed under legitimate rulers. The presence of an authority bestowed by God for the ordering of men in their civil relations is to be honored with a much higher standard of disposition on the part of the subject. Not only for wrath, he says, but also for conscience sake. Paul adds another reason for yielding that fit subjection to magistracy so constituted, so exercised, that it conforms both formally and actively to the moral law of God. See, wrath might be sufficient to suppress evildoers, but the apostle is actually addressing those who are seeking to be numbered among those who do good and receive praise. He's assuming that's what you really want. You don't just want to be that group over there, continually being hit on the head and finally having your head knocked off by the magistrate. You really want to be in this group receiving the praise, the approval of a good ruler. You want approval from lawful rulers. So he adds the bond of rightful and loyal subjection, the consideration of conscience. Now this word conscience admits of several shades of meaning, all of which, by the way, have bearing on the kind of subjection that is commanded here. Subjection for wrath's sake alone, he says, is not sufficient to avoid the charge, in fact, of resisting or rebelling. It is not sufficient for the rule of duty for those who seek to do that which is good themselves. Wrath curtails the evil, but it cannot of itself. The sword cannot of itself encourage that which is morally upright. This has to flow from some other source. And that the apostle isolates here and calls conscience. Now, first of all, when we speak of conscience, and there's a lot of discussion and debate about precisely what conscience is or is not. Conscience, the word conscience itself, we break it down, conscientia, it means to place knowledge side by side. It's a word very much like parable, where we're taking and putting two stories side by side to discern a meaning. Well, conscience is that capacity to place two things. In this case, in cases to which conscience is useful, we're going to take the facts of something and we're going to compare it with the rule, right, which is the moral law of God. So, conscience, at least at a primary level, speaks of an awareness, right, a consciousness of some information. So, in 1 Peter 2:19, Peter says, "For this is thankworthy if a man, for conscience toward God, endure grief, suffering wrongfully." You know, it connotes an inward sense that reflects a proper moral disposition towards some object, some event, some belief or practice that's been set before it for its consideration, for it's going to have this under consideration. However, and this is important, conscience depends upon some source of knowledge to work properly. Now, if man had not fallen, he would have all of the knowledge that he needed innately. But because of the fall, sin has darkened and twisted the consciences of men. Nonetheless, Paul, in 1 Corinthians 8:7, talks about conscience in this way and its function. He says, "Howbeit there is not in every man that knowledge. For some, with conscience of the idol, unto this hour eat as a thing offered unto an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled." So you need knowledge. There has to be some kind of knowledge. And that knowledge has to be conformed to what is right and wrong, what is good and evil. Second, conscience can speak of the attentiveness that is to be given to obligations. And so Paul says to Timothy, "Now the end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart and of a good conscience and of faith unfeigned." So in that sense, conscience connotes a conscious attention to the performance of something as a matter of duty. And it also carries with it the connotation of an awareness of the propriety, both of the obligation and of the fulfilling of that obligation. Third, conscience speaks of that inward faculty, which is able to distinguish between that which is morally right and that which is morally wrong. So Paul says in Romans 9:1, "I say the truth in Christ, I lie not, my conscience also bearing me witness in the Holy Ghost." He knows he's not lying. He knows that he has told the truth. And so it's this of which the apostle, I think, is primarily speaking here throughout this epistle. And this is from Romans 9:1 and elsewhere in Romans 2:15. He says of the Gentiles, "which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts, and meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another." So it's under this consideration then that Paul, I think, most directly intends us to understand the conscience when he says, "for conscience sake." This means then that Paul is characterizing the civil ruler, which is what's under discussion, as one who is to be submitted to, not only nor merely for wrath's sake, but that this civil ruler is an authority to which we can and should submit for conscience sake. And that means it has to be an authority which is answerable to the moral law. Because conscience, even of those without the written law, as Paul said in Romans 2, conscience bears witness to the work of that law upon it. Conscientious obedience is then a much higher degree of obedience than the mere passive obedience that certain people have been teaching in the Free Church continuing, and that was taught by the seceders and others of that ilk. Indeed, it can hardly be held that Paul is teaching a doctrine of passive obedience if we come to this verse when he invokes the faculty of conscience. How can this be? Furthermore, this conscientious obedience must be considered, number one, as to the constitution and character of the government or authority under consideration. How can a constitution which ignores moral law and a nation's favor to the light of the gospel, ignores the duties of Christianity, how can that be held to be an ordinance of God, let alone an ordinance which must command our conscientious obedience? As Christians, and Paul will emphasize this in Romans 14, we know that whatsoever is not of faith is sin. Yet how is it that we can have a conscientious regard for something that exists apart from or contrary to the moral law of God? How can this be? It's for this very reason that throughout their history, covenanters have refused to take oaths of allegiance, oaths of citizenship, or to participate in any activities which would amount to an incorporation with an immorally constituted civil magistracy. Covenanters do not vote. They do not serve on juries. They do not enlist in militaries which require oaths for service. And I know there are some pretty snarky people out there who think that they're covenanters, and yet they're in the U.S. military. You're not a covenanter if you're in the U.S. military. Period. You are a covenant breaker, and you are incorporated with an ungodly behemoth, the beast. And you need to get out of it and repent of the wickedness for propping up a government in rebellion to the Almighty. Don't call yourself a covenanter. It's taking God's name in vain. Additionally, it's sin to catch the words and try to salve them with the Jesuitical subtlety of what they call explanatory declarations and other verbal instruments they've designed to obscure the clear-minded intent of the one tendering the oath, contrary to the doctrine of oaths and vows. Again, second, conscientious obedience must have respect to the actual exercises of authority. While there might be some sort of fear factor with respect to enforcement of actual exercise, the principle of the apostle must still apply. We must be able to yield conscientious obedience, not only to the government as it's constituted, but also to its individual exercises pursuant to enforcing that authority. And if we can't, then this is not the ordinance of God. So, for conscientious obedience, it requires a lawful constitution and a lawful exercise of that authority at once. Should the first thing be lacking, lawful constitution, though it may be a lawful thing to do, it cannot be a lawful thing to do as a lawful command. Because a command implies an authority behind it. Should the second thing be lacking, lawful exercise, though it is the command of a lawful superior, it's simply not a lawful command. Now, the demand that these be observed with reference to the conscience, I think, proves that these authorities are not simply claims made and supported by providence alone. They can't be. These have to be rooted and grounded in the moral law of God if they're going to be any kind of legitimate authorities, whether in constitution or exercise. Because, you see, conscience, being a moral faculty consisting in the exercise of judgments and concurrences to that which is right, while shunning that which is evil, conscience can only function properly when it has reference to this moral law of God. Any attempt, then, to subvert or somehow disallow, get around the moral law of God is an attempt to subvert conscience. And yet, this is exactly, I think, what these modern proponents of seceder principles, which in this case are principles improperly so called, these modern proponents in the FCC and other churches like them, this is what they do, and this is what they teach men to do. And in so doing, they make men twice the sons of hell. Once, by substituting the precepts of men for the precepts of God, and again, by trying to enforce this imposture with a demand for your conscientious obedience to it. So Paul's speaking not merely of a providential appointment of magistracy, he's speaking of a good governor. He's speaking of one who in the concrete is in actual possession of the qualities which demonstrate the presence of a genuine authority rooted in the preceptive will of God. Because you see, no other claim could be an ordinance of God. Evil rulers and tyrants cannot lay claim to such a pedigree in the heavens without charging the God of heaven with being the author and approver of sin. Paul's ruler is one forged in conformity with the moral law. Paul's ruler is one that is a keeper of what we would call both tables of the law. His concern must be with man's duty to God as well as man's duty to man. Because the moral law does not admit of dissection or dismemberment. Remember what James says in James 2:10. For whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he's guilty of all. Can't divide the law. What are they thinking? It's sheer idiocy and wickedness that they would suggest that the magistrate is only responsible for the second table of the law. God damns that opinion. It's evil. Try to take apart his law and then say you've done nothing good, or nothing bad, I should say. Unlike the fear of wrath, which may arise and force men to yield obedience against their better judgment, or more to the point, against the moral law, Paul teaches that there has to be a corresponding conscience working in that obedience. So magistracy must really be the ordinance of God and not merely a claim to be such. It's not enough to claim. It must itself then be conformed to the moral law in its constitution as well as its exercise. And it's really to this alone to which a man, especially a Christian man, may yield conscientious obedience. Conscience must answer to the moral law. And only rulers who are constituted and then rule in accordance with that law can enjoin a conscientious obedience. I think in this verse, Paul destroys any plea for passive obedience. Invoking of the conscience is invoking an active and conscionable obedience that involves necessarily a conformity of thought and action which can say amen to the commanded obedience. Obedience for wrath's sake may be the sufficient condition for passive obedience. But obedience that demands more, that is, obedience for conscience' sake, is requiring men to stand up and take an active interest in their obedience so that they can say amen. Only active obedience, which requires a moral concurrence with the commands of the ruler, can rise to secure the higher obedience which the apostle here is demanding of the Romans, particularly Roman Christians. And so with verse 5, the doctrine of seceders regarding passive obedience is exploded, I think. And with the destruction of the doctrine of passive obedience, our friends in the Free Church continuing must explain how any Christian can yield conscientious obedience to any claim to magistracy which fails to meet the requirements of being an ordinance of God in its constitution or in its exercise. To quote Westminster Divine Edward Reynolds from his fourth sermon on Hosea 14, 3 and 4, he says, "Take away the obligation of the law upon conscience as a rule of life, and you take away from our love to God the very matter about which the obedience hereof should be conversant." The conscientious obedience, then, for which Paul contends, must be an obedience grounded in the obligation of the law of God. Of course, that is, after all, simply the doctrine of covenanters. For as Christians, we know that we're not without law, but we're under the law to Christ. Amen.